From the Sky News Centre at 5, the administrator dealing with Portsmouth is trying to reach a deal with the Premier League to sell players outside the transfer window. They're the first Premier League club ever to go into administration. Andrew Andronicou wants to offload one or two stars of the cash-strapped club, but has promised there won't be a fire sale. He also says manager Avram Grant will be staying at Fratton Park.
He's given his full support to stay with us to the end of the season. I think it'd be very naive of me to start looking at a new manager.
Latest figures confirm Britain's definitely out of recession, for the time being at least. Revised data shows the economy grew by 0.3% at the end of 2009. A memorial service has been held to mark the end of one of the most shameful episodes in British medical history. More than 10 years ago, it emerged staff at Alderhay Hospital in Liverpool had been routinely stripping hundreds of organs from dead children without families' permission. They were used for medical research. For bereaved parent Jan Eden, the memories are still raw.
My daughter Elizabeth died when she was 4 months old from cancer. The pain and hurt's there, but from that, I hope, positive things have come.
A man's been remanded in custody, charged with murdering his 100-year-old mother. Hannah Fitzgibbon died from a knife wound at her home in East London on Wednesday. Lloyds Banking Group is continuing to count the cost of its takeover of HBOS. The bank's revealed losses of £6.3 billion plus £24 billion in bad debts. Royal Mail failed to meet delivery target levels last autumn. A report shows nearly 79% of first-class stamped letters arrived the next working day after posting. That's below the 93% target. And Scotland's braced for more heavy snow tonight. Snowdrifts continue to affect road and rail networks, leaving hundreds stranded on roads. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Hardiman.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Digital TV switchover is coming to the West Region in March. Everybody in Bristol needs to be ready. Do you know someone who might need help in switching to digital TV? If they are 75 or over, registered blind or partially sighted, or eligible for disability benefits, the Switchover Help Scheme offers them practical help to convert one of their TV sets to digital. To get the help, they need to respond to the letter the Help Scheme has sent them. If you know someone who is eligible, give them a helping hand and remind them to apply for the help they are entitled to. You could even help them fill out their application form or ask them to call free on 0800 4087 656. The Switchover Help Scheme is run by the BBC under agreement with the government. For further information, visit the website helpscheme.co.uk. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Mondays at 5, it's Tom Bigwood. Tuesdays, it's Dean and Laura. Wednesdays, Jade Panyang. Thursdays, it's Phil Gibbons. But Fridays... Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and our guest on Bristol City Council's Budget Week to discuss some of the big stories in Bristol is Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Chair of Bristol City Council Audit Committee and temporary leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop. Our old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, no Billy Quayne again this week. He'll be back next week, but the Rupert Murdoch-owned Times has leaked today that the BBC are preparing to close BBC Six Music and possibly up to half of its website. Is this caving into pressure from Murdoch's a seemingly omnipotent News International? And we ask, what's happening to George W. Bush? On September the 11th, 2001, did you know that many people believe he was threatened using the code words Angel is next whilst in mid-air in the presidential jet Air Force One? But who may have been doing the threatening? That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Bristol's two-weekend, that is, weather forecast. This weekend, averaging 5 degrees Celsius, that's a little bit warmer than it's been recently, still pretty cold though, fairly dry on Saturday and wetter on Sunday. Next week, averaging again about 5 Celsius in the daytime, a fairly dry week with some sunny spells, possibly rainy around Wednesday evening and Thursday morning. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of March, again averaging 5 Celsius. A dry weekend with plenty of sunny spells, so it sounds like it's going to be a lot better next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news. And joining us this evening is Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim. He's also Chair of Bristol City Council Audit Committee and Temporary Leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop. Welcome to Drive Time, Jeff.
Thank you, Tony.
Now, tell us, first of all, are you yourself from Bristol?
I am. I'm a Bristolian and proud of it.
And what's your day job, if you have one, as well as being a councillor?
Yeah, I'm an accountant by day and a councillor in my, in part of the day and part of my spare time.
Now, how do you manage to find time to do both? Because it sounds like both would be, especially if you're in charge of the accounts on the City Council, it's going to demand quite a lot of time.
Yes, it's a challenge, but I actually think there's a danger that if the council is run by councillors who are full-time councillors, they're actually not meeting real people and coming across real situations. And I think it's very important that you actually get to mix with people in the normal course of work. So I'm meeting clients who are struggling with all the problems that every citizen in Bristol is struggling with, and I think that puts me in a much better position to understand what's going on.
So as an accountant, what kind of companies do you deal with? Is it small, medium, large, or what?
Small owner-managed businesses, people who are actually out there trying to earn a decent living and cope with all the struggles that the economy and the council throw at them.
So as it's budget week, onto the City Council's accounts, how publicly accessible are they? Does the public have access to the City's accounts? Can it go through the books and say, hang on a minute, what's this going on here?
Yes, there's a whole process of the accounts being audited and checked by an external auditor, and they're actually then available. Any member of the public can access them. I have to say that even those of us who've got a little bit of knowledge of them find them pretty baffling. So, in a sense, having the right to access them probably isn't a great deal of help.
Now, that makes me a bit nervous, because you're supposed to be auditing these accounts, going through them and making sure they're okay. So you have to ask quite a lot of questions, do you, about certain figures?
We have to ask a lot of questions. Part of the audit committee role, actually, is not to go into the detail of the figures, is to actually check that the people who run the council, the officers, have proper systems in place to make sure things are spent properly and decisions are taken properly. So ours is more of an advisory role rather than looking at the absolute detail. It's actually to make sure that things are in place to make it work properly.
So do the officers have these in place, have you found?
Yeah, Bristol has got a pretty good system of controls. There are always things that will go wrong. There will always be exceptions. What the systems are designed to do is to make sure that the normal decision-making is done in the correct and proper way. And to the best of what we've seen, yes, that is the case.
Now, does Bristol City Council get the revenue from business rates? This is something that I've wondered about over the years. I mean, obviously you're getting the council tax money, but what about the businesses? Because they're paying rates too for their business premises.
The answer to that question is yes and no. It doesn't get the revenue because the City Council acts as agent. It collects the money to the government and it pays it over to the government. But the government then pay back a figure that they've calculated by a formula, which usually comes out to relatively similar amounts of money. So it's it ultimately comes back to us, but when, for example, a whole new build goes on like Cabot Circus, we don't necessarily get back all of the contribution that comes in because it's retained by the Treasury and may be redistributed to other cities and other counties.
Okay, what about the bottom line, really, which is people who have to actually pay the council tax? Do you approve of it being taxing the occupants of the house rather than the actual owner of the property? Because this was something which was brought in, you know, sort of after the poll tax by Margaret Thatcher's government.
There's no easy way or totally fair way of collecting local taxes. Every route you go down is going to be open to advantage to some people and disadvantage to others. I think probably payment per property is probably as good a way as one can make it work. The bigger problem is that central government decides each year how much money it's going to give to local authorities, which in turn causes the council tax to have to go up. So one's got a situation where at the moment Bristol's going to be putting its council tax up by 2%, And my argument is very few people have seen their income go up by 2% in the last year, and many have seen it drop significantly. And that's the bit that I think is unfair. It's passing it on to local council taxpayers when they can't afford it.
OK, we're going to have a bit more of a look at the budget this later on in the programme. But Martin Summers is here too. Let's not forget Martin. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, you've said several times recently on this programme that you think that the economic situation in the world may actually precipitate war. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, I've said it because it's a fairly obvious thing, isn't it, when you've got economic crisis, as we've got at the moment, it's most serious since the 30s. The 30s led into the 1940s. The 1940s was a war. One can't say that that will definitely happen, but we've already got plenty of tension around the world. And when the pie gets smaller, people fight harder over what slice they're going to get. And, of course, that bears on what we're talking about council tax here, about people not being able to pay. I agree with the point that's just been made by Jeff. I think this isn't the time to increase people's taxes. But the problem is, as Jeff pointed out, that it's always going to be difficult to collect local taxes. And we've got a bit of a mishmash of system now in Britain. In Scotland, the SNP were pushing for a local income tax. The Liberals are calling for a local income tax. In Northern Ireland, you still have the rates because they never abolished the rates. And I think tax has got to be transparent and fair. And what we've ended up with is a bit of a mishmash and a mess. And we're still not, I mean, of course, any attempt to reform it only leads to further complications. But I think we need to have a good look at this, because we don't want to be taking money out of the pockets of the lowest paid at the moment. That's very bad for the economy.
OK, now the first story we're looking at this week, no surprises, is Wednesday's Bristol Evening Post announced, as the council did, that the council tax bills are going up 50 pence a week in Bristol. And I take it, Jeff, this is from April, is that right?
That's right.
So, yes, it's going up 50 pence a week. The figure does not take into account the police and fire precepts, over which the City Council has no control. That takes the total rise to about £35. The average... That's, I suppose, over a year, mustn't it? Yes. Mm-hmm. The average police precept will be £168 from April, up £7 on last year. Why is it, let's start off with you, Jeff, here. Why is it that you don't get any say over how much the police get? Because it's saying here that the police get at some sort of automatic figure, which the council doesn't have a say in.
Yeah, in the wonderful way that things work, the police authority is independent from the council. There are councillors who are members of the police authority and would be involved in that decision-making process, but the council has no say in it. The police authority determines what its contribution is going to be, and the council is simply obliged to collect it. It has no say in that figure.
Okay, and what are your general thoughts on the budget? Maybe you can give us a bit of an insight into some of the wrangling that went on this year.
Well, my concern, as I said earlier, is that I don't think the council tax should be going up at all in the current economic climate.
Given that the government aren't giving the City Council so much money, surely that means cuts, doesn't it?
Well,
in services,
I don't believe it needs to. In this year's budget, for example, there is a proposal to spend £500,000 next year on staff to enable neighbourhood partnerships to operate, and that includes one senior coordinating post at £100,000 a year. Now, I do not believe in the current economic climate the council should be employing additional officers at that package. The council is also spending a large amount of money on PR, on public relations, and has recruited senior staff into that department.
I can add to that, actually, that the Bristol City Council is known around the country as one of the councils that spends more as a proportion of its income on public relations, or what we might call propaganda, than any other city in the country.
Indeed, and my feeling is that the best PR a council can have is providing good services efficiently and effectively, and that we shouldn't be spending money. So I'm very keen that wherever possible, any cuts there are should be in administration and backroom operations, not in frontline services. And too often it's the frontline services, those who are actually dealing with those who are most at risk, where the cuts take place. And that's the bit I find very unacceptable.
Martin, what are your thoughts on what Jeff's been talking about here, and the idea of spending a little bit more on certain things like this £100,000 on
Well, I mean, there's always room for improvement, and cuts can probably be made in things which are not essential, but I don't think that solves the fundamental fiscal problem that cities like Bristol face. I mean, either way, the effective demand in the economy in Bristol is cut. You cut it by raising council tax, which of course takes money out of people's pockets so they can't spend it, or you cut services, in which case you're actually taking demand out of the economy as well, and especially if it's frontline services, you don't want to cut them. It's coming back to the point I made earlier about when the pie is shrinking, everybody argues about what slices of the pie they should have. I think we need to have a much more robust discussion about how the incidence of taxes, who pays and how. I think that the rating system, in actual fact, which was abolished by the last Conservative government, the rating system had been originally introduced in the reign of Elizabeth I, and it had been reformed along the way, but the reason why the rating system carried on was because it was actually a very effective way to raise money. If you tax property, property can't run away. Individuals, council tax is paid by individuals. Individuals can run away, individuals can evade. And of course, it's also a very regressive council tax. You need to actually use the property taxes.
But when when you're saying regressive, you mean it's a tax which falls more
on poor people than on rich people, and we're going to have a more robust discussion, whoever wins the next election, about the incidence of tax. It can't be right that those who've benefited so much from the boom should not be paying their way now, as we need to rebuild public finances to prevent our credit from becoming no good in the world. And that's not just about cutting. We don't want to cut wages of low-paid people, and we don't want to cut frontline services. That means we've got to cut some waste, and in local councils that might be PR. At national level it might be things like Trident. But the point is that we've actually got to raise the tax base back to where it was before the bubble was created, and that means basically that wealthy people have to pay more. But that's just the way it is.
So, Jeff, as a Conservative, what are your thoughts on what Martin's saying there, the idea that actually, there's no point in trying to tax the poorer half of the population anymore. We need to do things like stop tax avoidance and these kind of places like the Channel Islands, where people base themselves in the Channel Islands in order that they don't have to pay any income tax.
Well, I certainly agree. We've got to stop tax avoidance or tax evasion. There is an enormous amount, so one understands, going on amongst those who can afford to pay for it. And, of course, those who can't afford to pay for it carry on paying taxes at the normal rate. But, I mean, one of the issues I have a real concern about is that the increase in income tax to 50% with effect from the start of the next tax year for those earning over £150,000, the perceived view appears to be that that will simply result in less tax being paid, because people will in fact find other means of avoiding the tax. So I think, yeah, I understand exactly the point Martin's making, but I think we've got to be very careful that tax is effectively collected. And if you start to make the tax rates excessive on those who earn more, the danger is that they will go abroad to live and work and earn and pay taxes. And that leaves those of us who are left here having to foot the bill even more. So that's a real concern.
But what about the concern about people who are on low wages who are being taxed and then actually simply can't afford to pay the tax? Surely that's equally difficult.
The system has, in my view, gone mad. We've got a situation where we've got a vast bureaucracy paying out benefits to people, and we've got another bureaucracy that's taking tax from them. And it really does seem to me that there needs to be a very serious reform. One needs to be looking at the levels at which benefits are paid, because they should be paid to those who are in real need, but they shouldn't necessarily be being paid to people on fairly significant levels of income, which is currently the case.
When you're talking about people on benefits, I mean, obviously the workers at the Keynsham Cadbury's factory are right now thinking about possibly being on the dole.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts about, you know, using taxpayers' money through the Royal Bank of Scotland to fund that deal that actually has ended up with a death sentence on the Cadbury factory and on 400 jobs?
I don't fully understand all the mechanisms that took place to bring that deal about, but it does seem to me that I have a real concern that this country has little enough manufacturing of any sort going on within it, and if we can't protect what manufacturing industry we've got from takeover by foreign competitors who are then going to close it down. I believe it's a dereliction of duty by the government at the time. And I have to say, there are very few other European countries that would allow a major international, a major national name in their country to be taken over and then close down a plant. And I think, you know, if others can do it and still comply with the EU regulations, why did our government have to let this happen? I don't think it's right, and particularly, as you say, when they own the bank that has made the finance possible.
OK, just back to the council budget, which has been announced this week. The Liberal Democrats have said that they're pouring £500,000 into digital investment, money to help people use the internet and get access to broadband. Council leader Barbara Jenks said being able to work from home or just seek out cheaper deals on goods and services on a home computer is thought to be worth £300 a year to each individual. Well, that sounds to me like a good investment. Would you agree with that, Jeff?
I would agree with it if they'd actually had a very clear indication of what that £500,000 was going to be spent on. What surprised me was that 3 weeks before the budget debate, and even days before the budget debate, we still had no clear idea of where that money was going. And what it really gave the impression of was a bright idea that someone had pulled together where they said, let me have that money, and now I've got it, let's see what we can spend it on. And that, to me, is a prime example of the sort of things we shouldn't be going. However good the idea is, if it's not thought out and clear, and that we all know what it is we're agreeing to, it shouldn't go ahead.
Well, I wonder whether your audit committee will be poring over that during the next year to make sure the money's been spent properly.
I think it's quite possible that we might be just looking at that with some interest.
OK. On to our next story then. And a Bristol councillor is fighting a rare illness in intensive care at French Hay Hospital. That's Bishopsworth councillor, who was on this programme a couple of months ago. Richard Eddy is recovering in hospital after being struck down by a rare illness of the nervous system. He's the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, and he has Guillain-Barré syndrome, which causes limb paralysis and loss of sensation. Anyway, maybe you could just give us an update on how Richard's getting on, Jeff.
Yeah, well, Richard, I'm telling you now, 3 weeks ago, Thursday evening, Richard was chairing a meeting. He was fine, perfectly fit and well. By the Sunday, he was in hospital, and by a week later, he was in intensive care. I understand that his position is now improving, but he is still not very well at all, and it's going to be a month or two for him to show any signs of recovery and start to get his strength back, and it's frightening. It's frightening that this sort of thing can hit anybody. I'd never heard of it before. I suspect you hadn't either. But it's something that left him, I'd say, extremely unwell. I'm battling to recover.
So, can you just tell us about Richard a bit? What's the Conservative group lost while he's in hospital?
Well, Richard, as leader, was a full-time councillor, so he represented both the group and the council, all manner of meetings, involved in developing policy, involved in developing our strategy, and basically campaigning and putting the Conservative message across. So we've lost, you know, one of our key assets, if you like. He was always there as a voice of the Conservative Party. So the rest of the group are now having to take that role and share it out between us.
Okay, well, let's just wish Richard a speedy recovery here, and hope he gets well soon. Okay, next story. I don't really think you need to comment on that one, Martin, do you?
Apart from to wish him well.
Yeah, thanks. Anyway, pressure on a Tory leader. This is a different Conservative leader here. This is David Cameron, over his advisor's activities. This is quite a complex story, and it's been in the headlines in The Guardian yesterday and the day before. The British opposition leader David Cameron has been drawn into a fresh scandal over claims his director of communications, Andy Coulson, was still editor of the Murdoch tabloid News of the World when the paper hired a private detective who'd recently been released from a 7-year prison sentence for blackmail. In a sensational development, The Guardian said Mr. Coulson was under intense pressure to defend his editorship and disprove allegations about his knowledge of illegal telephone bugging by his reporters. The private investigator was well known to the newspaper's hierarchy, including Mr. Coulson, who was deputy editor when he was hired. He had worked on a number of projects before being jailed and was rehired after serving his sentence. The Guardian reports it's seen evidence that the investigator, who cannot be named because he's before the courts accused of a violent crime, bribed police officers, traded sensitive information from live police inquiries, and hacked into bank accounts. He was also involved in obtaining confidential data from the motor registry and driving license departments and telephone companies. Now, this is surely leaving David Cameron with a bit of egg on his face here, Jeff. This chap, Andy Coulson, sounds like he's every bit as dodgy as Alistair Campbell, who was the sort of much hated spin doctor of Tony Blair. So can you reassure us that we're not going to have another Alistair Campbell type figure hanging around if David Cameron takes the reins?
I don't have a lot of time for spin, whichever side it's on. I think this sort of thing is always very difficult to tell. No one's fully clear what the guy knew about what was going on.
Well, he was the editor of the newspaper at the time.
Absolutely, but one's not entirely sure what he knew and what was happening there. I think he's in a very different role. I have to say, I'd rather go back to the stages where parties stood by their policies for what they really were, rather than where they had people to promote them. And I'd say that for both the current government and for the opposition, I think they should stand on the policies alone.
But I mean, whilst he was editor, there was a bullying going on, and it's been proved now. And in fact, the biggest award ever in the history of the British press, £800,000, was awarded to the reporter who it was shown had been bullied at the paper at the time. And since he's in charge, surely there's some implication for Andy Coulson there.
I don't know enough about it to actually interpret that. What I always do find is very strange is when we have journalists of any description making moral judgments about other people in the public eye, when many of them, as you're showing here, don't actually run their house in the way that the rest of us would consider to be acceptable.
But I mean, do you think it's appropriate to have someone who's from the News of the World style of journalism to be David Cameron's right-hand man? Wouldn't it be more like, say, The Times or The Telegraph, you know, possibly a broadsheet type person?
But you see, there you're highlighting the very issue that the Conservative Party's got a challenge with at the moment. For too long, it would have recruited people who were Times or Telegraph, and it would have promoted to the very people who actually supported it already. What this is a recognition of is the whole way the Conservative Party now sees itself, which is actually a party that represents people across class and across culture, and therefore it's needing to look in a different way from the way it has done in the past. It produces some interesting divisions between those who are long-term members of the party and some who are new to it and maybe have different views, but it actually shows how things are changing in politics.
Well, I'd just like to agree with what Jeff said earlier. It would be much better if the parties stood on what their principles were rather than on spin. There's an element of that sounding like motherhood and apple pie. I mean, as a Labour Party supporter, I was never very happy with Alistair Campbell's role. Many of the things that he did, I was bitterly opposed to.
But aren't the political parties now, all of them, really reliant on things like News International? You know, the Murdoch newspaper empire. We've had this famous situation with The Sun saying, we're no longer supporting Labour, we're going to support the Conservative Party. And, of course, that's very important for a party in the run-up to a general election.
Well, it is, and, of course, Party leaders are very concerned to get newspapers on side. They're very concerned to get backers on side who've got money, and that's a very important problem for political leaders. But I think we need to actually change the terms of the debate. We've got the most serious economic crisis that we've faced in a generation, and we need to have a serious, serious discussion about what we are all going to do to resolve the problems that face us. And I think personalising politics, attacking people's personal behaviour, attacking people's personalities, playing the man, not the ball all the time. I think the public are fed up with this. And I think that hopefully, going forward, whatever happens in the election, we are going to start talking to each other like adults, because we certainly need to do that.
We've had a whole load of stuff this week, of course, about bullying, alleged bullying by Gordon Brown and anger in Number 10. What are both of your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of that kind of story? Because, of course, eventually it turned out that the woman from the bullying helpline, it didn't seem like their charity was quite as robust long-term as people had first thought. Martin?
Okay. Well, I mean, I think that it's a personality politics. I mean, obviously, the personality of the Prime Minister does matter to some extent. But I noticed, for example, that Anne Widdecombe, who's a long-serving Tory MP, resigned from the board of the charity immediately because she said you can't be using private phone calls to your charity as a political weapon in an election campaign. These are, you know, it's just an abuse of your privilege.
I mean, do you think this is the sort of tactics that you like to see from the top of your party, or is it something you like to distance yourself from, Jeff?
I mean, I agree with Martin. I find it remarkable that any charity would disclose confidential information of that nature. Bullying should be outlawed wherever and whenever it happens. Whether or not it happened at number 10, who can tell? But one's got to recognise it's bound to be a pressured environment. And so, you know, I think one's got to have an element of sympathy with the circumstances, but you can't prejudge, and I don't think we'll ever know the truth.
Okay, and we had a little discussion about Charles Kennedy and him being removed as leader of the Liberal Party for drinking, and then sort of mentioned the fact that, of course, Winston Churchill was a bit of a drinker himself, and he was one of the most popular politicians of all time. Anyway, let's go back to another local story now, and the biofuel plant has been rejected in a landmark planning decision. This is from the website bristol247.com that broke the story first. Bristol City Council threw out an application to build a controversial biofuel power plant in Avonmouth after rejecting the legal advice and planning officer's reports. At a heated meeting in the council house this week, members of the biofuel plant application, the Development Control Committee North, voted 6-2 against the plan submitted by something called W4B Bristol to build a green energy plant to power the equivalent of 25,000 homes. Well, everyone knows we need to have new forms of energy. What are your thoughts on this one, Jeff?
Well, first of all, I'd just say I've avoided in all my years on council being on a planning committee, because when you serve on a planning committee, it's very confusing in that you have to, you're effectively in a sort of legal position, and you're meant to be taking a view on the planning facts that are presented to you. Now, what, in this case, was a planning application, which I have to say, I could see no merits for it whatsoever, as far as I could see, in terms of the green ecological nature, it didn't seem to stack up. But the very difficulty for the council is that if it turns out the refusal was on political grounds rather than planning grounds, it may cost the council a great deal of money when the applicant takes the issue to appeal. So this issue won't go away. If the applicant chooses to appeal, the council will have to defend its position, and it may well cost the council and therefore council taxpayers a lot of money. So this story's got some way to go, I'm afraid.
Do you think that there's a matter of principle as well, though, that if a planning committee feels that no matter what the basic planning guidance says, that they think that this is the wrong kind of application that they have? It's a little bit like the system with ordinary courts in a jury trial, where the jury can actually ignore the advice of the judge if they want to.
I think the planning committee decision should stand. One of the inequities of the situation is that if the planning committee refuses an application, the applicant can go to appeal and go to government to get them to investigate. If, however, that had been granted, the 1,100 people who objected could have done nothing. They couldn't go to appeal. So actually, in that sense, it's not like a court decision, because the appeal only works one way. If there's a negative decision, you can't go appeal against it if it's positive. So no, I mean, in my view, I'm happy with the outcome. I think it was I don't think it is appropriate. There was nothing in the evidence I saw to suggest that actually it was sustainable and that there were any ecological benefits in it being there.
Martin.
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with all of that. I mean, the law, planning law, is rigged against objectors and in favour of developers. And we had Councillor Barbara Lewis on the programme a couple of weeks ago, and she's the chair of the committee and a Conservative, and she was actually disagreeing with me and saying that no, in actual fact, we can object, and you can object, but you can be overruled by the developer. And
yes, she's the chair of this committee.
Yes, but as Jeff points out, I mean, if the law ultimately is on the side of the developer, then a protest could end up costing Bristol money. I mean, that leaving aside the merits of whether we should have a biofuel plant or not, on that, I would like to point. I'd just like to mention that I went on a trade union delegation to Colombia some years ago, and what's happening in Colombia is that peasants are being driven off the land by paramilitary thugs, and once they've gone, their land is being planted with biofuel by big companies. And so if you remember a couple of years ago, everybody was talking about biofuel as a green fuel. I think that has now passed on, and now biofuel is now recognised as rather dangerous to people in developing countries and not a green fuel at all.
Right. Now we're about halfway through the first hour of the programme, and it's time to take a break from the news review to hear our guest Jeff Gollop's choice of music. Now, Jeff, what's this song and why did you choose it?
Well, I've chosen Crocodile Rock by Elton John, and I've chosen it because it brings back happy memories. It's the sort of music I enjoy listening to, and it brings back happy memories of the concert in Bristol when he performed, and my wife and other members of the family dancing along to it while I, as you'd expect of an accountant, sitting comfortably and watching them and enjoying it.
Okay, well, we'll enjoy watching you dancing to it here in the studio. John and Crocodile Rock. That's chosen by today's guest on BCFM 93.2's Friday Drive Time, Jeff Gollop, acting Conservative Group Leader on Bristol City Council. Now, back to our review of the week's news, and I notice that we have an article in today's Evening Post about transport. Now, There is a MPs are calling for an authority to oversee transport, and I notice, Jeff, that all of the councillors and MPs that are against the idea of a strategic transport authority in the South West seem to be Conservatives. Are you one of the Conservatives who's also against this is some kind of committee to oversee transport in the whole of the South West?
But it's interesting you pass that comment. My view is that Bristol needs some form of strategic transport authority.
To be fair, it's mostly North Somerset councillors, Conservative councillors, who are against this.
Yeah. And the reason why I believe it needs it is because Bristol is in the situation where those who travel to work in Bristol are largely people who live outside Bristol. And we actually need to work very closely with our neighbouring authorities to find ways of solving the transport problems, because Bristol's collective prosperity depends on people being able to travel, access their work, access their shops, access their leisure. And we are in danger of getting to the stage where that's not possible. And we can't solve it on our own. We need to solve it with other councils. We need to make sure that actually, you know, buses and trains coordinate and actually, you know, one service leads on to another and people can actually get where they want to get to.
We're in a kind of crazy situation, aren't we? Because once you get to a certain level of congestion, I mean, for example, at the end of Ashley Road last week, the traffic lights were out for a day and actually the traffic was flowing much better. I don't know why this is, but it seems like that the traffic lights can even make things worse. I would imagine if there's no traffic lights at all, that the whole lot would just grind to a halt. But we're in a situation where we're trying to control the present situation rather than try and relieve the congestion by improving public transport and alternatives to using the car.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. And there's got to be some positive solution, because otherwise, say, prosperity in the city is going to suffer massively.
Well, maybe you can have a word with some of your Conservative friends in North Somerset. Martin, anyway, what are your thoughts about this story?
Well, I mean, there does obviously need to be strategic planning for transport. What's astonishing to me is that we've had a Labour government for over a decade and they're now talking about having strategic planning. I mean, there was talk, if you remember...
It's a bit late in the day, isn't it?
It is a bit late in the day. If you remember, John Prescott was transport czar, if you remember that, some years ago, and there was going to be joined up policy on transport. And then the lobbies kicked in, the road lobby, the haulage lobby, etc., and nothing was ever done. And to be honest with you, if the Labour Party loses the next election, as they may seriously looks as if they may do, what it will be because they didn't actually carry through on some of the things that they said they were going to do. They caved into special interests, and then of course when you've done that, it's very hard to call on people and say back us for another go.
Okay, back to looking at this week's budget again, and I brought along with me into the studio a lovely old blue book with the city's crest on it. The City and County of Bristol, it says, Abstract of Accounts 1946 to 47. And whilst we're on the subject of transport, I'll just open these accounts at the page which looks at the Transport Committee from 1947. Now, obviously, there weren't private cars in any sorts of the numbers that there are today around in those days, but this is when the City Council was running the local corporation buses. We see expenditure £3,700,000 and income £3,900,000. So they're turning a £200,000 profit back in mid-40s or late-40s on running transport. Now, the situation now is that we're quite massively subsidising transport, isn't it, Jeff? Is there any way that we can get back to the days after the Second World War where Bristol City Council was turning a profit on running transport?
Well, as a Conservative, you'd expect me to not welcome the days when the City Council actually owned the bus service. And I wouldn't want to see that happening again. But there are a number of things that I don't understand about transport in Bristol. I'm not closely involved with the finances of it, but I don't understand why Bristol bus fares happen to be as high as they are.
Well, isn't it simple? It's just because First Bus can have a virtual monopoly and they can charge what they want.
Indeed. And I then don't understand why, when the City Council's looking for people to run subsidised bus services, that the majority of those services tend to be provided by First Bus, because it actually would be a golden opportunity to encourage other operators to provide more services than they currently do, because we need more competition in the city to ensure that First Bus prices are reduced.
Well, as a Labour Party supporter, you will probably not be surprised to know that I would be quite happy for the buses to be run by the local authority. And I think that what we've done over a generation is we've forgotten things that used to be common ground between the parties. I'm quite sure that the Conservatives supported Bristol City Council running the buses in the 1940s. That was the consensus of the period. And there's an intellectual reason why, which is that competition is very difficult to organise when you've got spatial monopoly. It's most unlikely that you're ever going to get more than two or maximum three bus companies operating in Bristol. Their pricing strategy is going to be collusive, not competitive. You don't actually want three lots of buses coming down a road competing with each other. In actual fact, what you need to have is a plan. And I'm not saying, I make no apologies for that. The market can do so many things, but you do need to have a plan. And of course, in the 1940s, after the Second World War, the word plan was not actually a dirty word. People knew that planning is what had won the war, and that's why planning was the method that they used to try and deal with problems after the war.
Jeff, do you disagree with that, Jeff, or do you think that we should actually, it is part of the council's remit to sit down and plan things like this, or do you just simply do what the central government tell you? You don't really have much of an opinion.
Oh, I'm not a believer in doing what central government tells me, even if it was my own party in government. So I think very much we need to make transport work to solve Bristol's problems. And I'm glad Martin and I found something to actually disagree on in terms of who should own the buses, but I don't disagree with the fact that transport needs planning. And one of my concerns is that when we talk about transport at the moment, we're talking about what we might need to get through next year. What we ought to be doing is looking at what Transport Bristol is going to need in 20 years' time and make sure we plan to make sure that we improve the transport service over the next 20 years.
But what about what Martin was saying there about, you know, transport being a kind of natural monopoly or certainly a duopoly that usually, because it takes so much investment to run a bus company with bus garages and all that sort of thing, that you're never going to get more than one or two bus companies in any city.
I think that's right, but what I still don't understand is if you compare Bristol bus fares to other cities which have similar monopolies and duopolies, our bus fares are massively higher. And we will only improve the transport situation if consultation, discussion, resolution to problems, we actually find ways of overcoming the current problem. If at the moment everybody chooses, or a lot of people choose to use their cars because bus fares are so expensive, then inevitably it's going to create a situation where the providers have to put up their bus fares even more because it takes them longer to get their buses through the transport and they have less passengers.
But it's your party that believes in the idea of the shareholders' rule, you know, the shareholders will motivate the owners of the bus companies to do the right thing. And what's happening here with First Group, clearly, is that the shareholders are just saying, look, we want more money. And they're not really looking at the service at the end of the day. That's where, you know, it seems to me, most of the power is within the First Group, is that the management are trying to make sure the shareholders simply get as much of a dividend as possible, and that means that the Bristol public suffers.
What I don't understand is why that is happening in Bristol and it's not happening to the same extent in other places. And that's the bit I want to understand more about, because I actually believe that the shareholders would benefit most by producing an effective, cost-effective bus service that actually encourage more people to use it. And that's the bit I don't understand. We've got to the stage where they're maximising revenue by maximising fares. I believe the model that they ought to be applying is one whereby they identify they could maximise revenue by actually getting a lot more people on the buses by reducing their fares.
And that's exactly what happens in London, run by Boris Johnson, where the buses are owned by the GLC and still owned, and everything's run by London Transport. And of course, there was never any attempt to privatise in London or to create competition, because it was obviously going to create chaos. So therefore, even under Conservative governments, they backed off from it.
I think I'm right in saying that what they've got in London is a strategic authority that makes decisions about who's going to get which route to make sure that there is a vast amount of competition over different bus companies. Anyhow, let's just get back to the council tax for a moment, since it's council tax week, and our reporter Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you whether you think you get value for money by paying your council tax from the city council.
Do you get value for money from your council tax?
No. I always wonder where it goes in Bristol, because the buses are expensive. Public transport, you know, is utterly hopeless. It's the worst city in the world that I've been to for public transport, and I've visited hundreds of cities. I mean, there should be some kind of light railway system. They should reinstate the old railway lines. They should certainly have a decent network of buses, but it just seems hopeless. And also, where's all the money gone for the cycle tracks? They got £23 million, as I recall, about a year ago for all the cycle routes. And, well, it's just gone, hasn't it? I used to cycle an awful lot around Bristol, and as far as I can see, they've produced maybe a mile of new cycle routes. And, you know, where's the rest of it gone?
I don't live in this council. I live in North Somerset, but I don't really think so, no.
Generally speaking, it's okay, but I think it probably could be better.
I'd say some things you do, but other things you don't. Things like public transport's not very good, but other things like the NHS seems to be improving. More money on public transport and police, maybe less on sort of benefit claimants.
I think I do, yes, but I think more recycling could be done. They don't take as many items for recycling as they could do, and on public transport for sure. I think the buses could do with a lot more sort of infrastructure.
I rent a flat, so I don't really pay council tax, to be honest, but I believe it's pretty fair value, yes. Generally, I think the services are pretty poor. I know, for example, the bins recently were very badly organised with the snow, and I think it's just a lot of other ways it can be spent.
Which council services do you use?
Well, obviously they collect my bins. I occasionally use public transport. And I suppose, without thinking, I use all the other services you don't see, like street lighting, you know, highway maintenance, things like that. But that's about it, really.
I haven't been to a library for a very long time. I do read, but I tend to sort of buy books rather than...
I don't use a lot. I don't really use the buses myself, but... just the regular ones, like the waste management.
Yeah, I guess a lot of the leisure facilities we use. The buses I use now and again, really. Obviously the bin service, lighting.
Have you any message for Bristol City Council's budget item?
Yeah, get your act together. Start building more cycle routes, safe cycle routes, not just pretty lines painted on a road. A decent bus network, and reinstate the railway lines.
Just try and spend it wisely, and don't throw it away.
I think, yeah, just to really consider what residents want a little more, I think.
So, Jeff, do you think that you consider what residents want enough on the City Council?
I don't think we do. The council newsletter that goes out through every door in Bristol is deemed to be sufficient public consultation. But interestingly, in spite of it being distributed to every household, only a very small number of people actually reply and come back to it. And I think we've got to find other ways of engaging with people to find out what they think. And I certainly believe, as one of your interviewees said, we can do better, and we've got to try and do better.
Well, if you come talking about the thing that comes through everybody's doors with a sort of Barbara Jenk gives a little chit-chat at the start, I think the reason that the council's doing this, isn't it, simply so that they can get the message across in the way that they want, whereas if they were to release this information via us or the BBC or the Evening Post, it would be kind of filtered and criticised. And so do you think it's actually justified to spend... How much is spent on magazines like this, and how much does the city spend on public relations?
Well, the actual public relations budget in total last year, for the coming year, I think is something like £2.5 million. I don't have to hand the figures for the newsletter, but I think it's back to our discussion earlier. It's about spin. Actually, putting out press releases and having them commented on by journalists is actually what's transparent. It's actually there for readers and listeners to then hear what's going on. When it's put out like that in a sanitised way by the City Council, I have a feeling it alienates a large number of potential readers before it starts, so it's not actually achieving what it sets out to do.
Martin, what are your thoughts on this? The Vox Pop
well,
you just heard, and particularly
think,
on this propaganda.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but the vast majority of the money that the City Council spend doesn't come from council tax anyway. It comes from the central spending assessment. So what we need to do, in my view, is to reform local taxation. I think there was nothing wrong with the rating system, which we had for many hundreds of years. The wealthy classes always complained and moaned about the rating system. They moaned in the 15th century. They moaned
but hang
in the
on, Martin,
century.
We're now talking about how the money's spent, not how we get it, yeah?
This no, is what, this I, is what this I think, as one of your contributors said, we'll spend it wisely, and that means that there should be transparency, and where people think waste is going on, then they should point their finger and say that's wasteful. So I wouldn't like to comment too much about the PR budget, but I would point out that it's only 2.5 million, and Jeff will understand that that's actually quite small in terms of what the government, what terms of what the council actually spends. I think there does need to be some accountability to local voters, but of course, in the past, cities like Bristol raised most of their money from local taxation on property. That's how it was run in the 19th century. Now, we don't want to go back to the 19th century, but I think we're going to have a really good look at how we collect money for local and national government. And this comes back to having a transparent and robust discussion about tax and who pays what. And coming back to Jeff's much earlier point about income tax can be evaded, property taxes can't be evaded, and also property taxes mean that you take the sting out of bubbles before they get going, so they've got a double whammy of effectiveness. I think we need to look at the taxation system very seriously.
Right, on to another story now. This is the Daily Mail on Tuesday, the Doomsday Book 2010. Strip clubs are soaring, libraries are disappearing, the figures which lay bare life in modern Britain. Now, this compares 1997 to 2010, and the changing face of Britain under Labour has been laid bare. And this is actually a government report, which the Daily Mail are calling a modern doomsday book. It shows how traditional pubs, post offices and libraries have gone by the wayside. In their place, bookmakers, nightclubs and supermarket chains have flourished. Now, what's going on here, Jeff? Do you think these are changes for the better?
No, none of them. I think...
But surely this is the market. This is what the Conservatives believe in.
This is the Labour government's licensing laws, largely. One has a situation where the 24-hour drinks licence, which is may have its place in city centres, but doesn't really have its place in the suburbs in and around Bristol. And you know, I've seen it in my own ward, and I suspect most people have seen it where they live. Post offices closed, but bars and pubs and nightclubs opening. Now, I'm sure there must be people somewhere who think that's a good idea, but I don't think so, and it's not what the community wants. And one's got a bizarre situation that the licensing rules and the planning rules are allowing one thing to happen, whereas the community that actually uses those services doesn't. Why should one want to see libraries closed, but certainly post offices closing, when they provide a real service?
Well, do you think that the public should be more involved then in the whole process of licensing and you were talking about planning too? Just simply giving the public a right to appeal?
I think what it means actually is that the public ought to be involved and consulted in government legislation. I haven't actually found anybody who wants the 24-hour licensing legislation, and yet the Labour Party brought it in, and they forced it on local communities to the detriment of many local neighbours.
But don't you think that most members of the public, when they're consulted, feel that afterwards they're then ignored?
I would agree with you. It's certainly something I see going on in the City Council, that very often, as long as they've consulted, they can tick the box that said we've had a consultation. Digressing slightly, but a prime example of this is the controlled parking zones, where after consultation, the Cabinet in Bristol has decided that those who didn't vote must have been in favour, and therefore it can go ahead. Consultation, if it needs to be done and acted upon, not then ignored.
Martin, what are your thoughts on this report in Tuesday's Daily Mail, a government report with all the changes that have been since the Labour Party got in?
I think it's a very sad indictment of New Labour's stewardship of the economy and of planning. They basically decided that they were going to get, they were put under pressure by vested interests. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, lap dancing clubs and betting shops are very profitable enterprises, and the Labour government and decided that they were going to give these people their head. I'm glad to see that we're finding common ground here about the fact that that's not a very good idea. I think the Labour Party has not been true to its own roots, to its own tradition, and to its own values when we're closing post offices, swimming pools, and libraries, and opening lap dancing clubs, betting shops, and casinos. And I think that's sums up New Labour's decade in power, doesn't it?
OK, just before the Sky News at 6, we've got time for one more story. That's the front page of today's Evening Post. That's the height of disgrace. They're looking at the terrible state of the Cabot Tower, just up Brandon Hill, sort of halfway up Park Street. Jeff, what's going on? Do you have any insight into this? Why has this tower been left in this dreadful state for the last couple of years?
I can't tell you why, but I raised this with council officers a couple of weeks ago. I have been assured that funding is in place from English Heritage, but they only have verbal assurance at this stage, and they are waiting for written assurance, and when the written assurance comes in, work will start within the next couple of months. That's what I've been told. I won't believe it until it starts happening. What I can't begin to comprehend is why it's taken 3 years, for goodness sake. For a Bristol landmark like that, it's an embarrassment.
Martin?
Well, I don't know enough about this to have a very strong opinion, but obviously...
Yeah, but I mean, this is one of the most important landmarks in the city.
Obviously, we don't want
it's now covered with graffiti.
Yes, well, obviously, we don't want these kind of things to be happening, but if I knew how to fix it, I'd be fibbing if I said I knew what the blockage was.
OK, thanks. It's coming up to the Sky News at 6 time, thanks to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Chair of Bristol City Council Audit Committee and temporary leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop. Next week... At 5 on Friday Drive Time, we're joined by Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows.